What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Managing Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we're joined by Senior Writer Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how's it going? I have some fun trivia. Did you know that it is the 30th birthday of our parent company, Yahoo, this week?
Hooray. Oh, man, Yahoo turns 30. And also, podcast producer Ben Elman is here. Hey, Ben.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, we are talking about the Pixel 9a, a phone which I feel like I was shocked it was not already out because there was so much talk about it and like so many details about it. I was like, how? That thing came out already, right? No. But now it was announced this week. Google just announced it, even though it's not available until April. So there's some, like, I don't know, some controversy there. We'll be diving into that and also some news, some sad news in the state of America, and also all sorts of stuff. But as always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Thanks. You can also join us Thursday mornings around 11 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel, where we're streaming live, we're showing off gadgets, we're doing Q&As with the audience. It's a fun time. Join us. The Pixel 9a is here, and I'm sure some people are excited, but I feel like the main takeaway, guys, is that it is a $499 mid-range phone with all the features we want, and it's exactly what we were yelling at the iPhone 16e about, right, Sam, Sherlyn?
Yes, and critically, $100 less expensive than the iPhone 16e. And so, you know, this phone is not really a surprise. You know, you kind of alluded to it before, but, like, you know, there are some reviewers in other countries who just got devices way ahead of time. And before the, you know, device was officially announced, they were just, you know, making reviews about it. So it seems like it's kind of out there. And it's, you know, Google's been doing this for a long time. Every spring they come out with the A series, kind of mid-range, more affordable take on the standard Pixel. And that's pretty much what we got again this year with the Pixel 9a. Now, you know, there's a couple small differences. There's no camera bar, which is kind of like a, you know, signature design feature of the Pixel line. It's almost flush, but you do get two cameras instead of one, like on the 16e, and you still get a full Tensor, not quite a full Tensor G4 chip. It's got a kind of reduced cores, but almost all the same capabilities. Nice, 120 hertz OLED display. And so it's really got basically everything you want from, you know, your standard Pixel 9, but for $300 less. And it just, you know, it seems like a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm. And more features than like the base iPhone 16, honestly, I think in many ways. Like they have the fast refresh rate screen, which we've been talking about forever. Sherlyn, thoughts on this one?
I mean, there's quite a lot of things, and Sam already pointed out, right? So the difference between the 16e and the Pixel 9a, in addition to iOS versus Android, is, yeah, that dual camera, which to me is a huge deal. And Google has historically been better at processing photos too, so they'll look better anyway. Yep. And then secondly,
Google has actually said that they think it's going to be the best camera quality on any phone under $500.
Yeah. Then there's the screen refresh rate is much better. It's like, you know, you and I, Devendra, have talked ad nauseum about how much importance it is to have a faster refreshing screen than 60 hertz. Well, and then on top of everything else, Sam, this Pixel 9a has a 5,100 milliamp hour battery. It's the biggest in the Pixel 9 lineup.
On any Pixel on sale right now. Yep.
Really?
Which should be huge for battery life. And the 16e, I believe, for other reasons, including the C1 modem, as well as actually a bigger battery as well, is among one of the like longest lasting iPhones that Apple rolled out this year as well. So the similarity there to me is like, are you paying less money for better battery life? And in that case, yay, like, shall we keep, you know, like, I will spend less money and get better battery life. And Sam, I know this is your thing, like you're passionate about this. Wireless charging as well as wired charging speeds. Can you tell us where the Pixel 9a stands on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, at least unlike the iPhone 16e, which doesn't have wireless charging at all, you do get, you know, 7.5 watt wireless charging, which is slow, but
I
not...
I got a button there. I believe the 16e has wireless charging.
Oh, does it have wireless charging?
7.5 watt. Yeah, okay. 7.5.
It has
no MagSafe.
Okay.
But 7.5 watts as well.
So it sounds like they're about the same, at least in terms of wireless charging, 7.5 watts.
Yes.
And then you have 23 watt wire charging, which is okay, but still slower than what you get on a, you know, a standard Pixel. And that's kind of one of Google's like kind of selling points to try to push people towards the Pixel. I'm not sure that's going to work because, you know, if you don't have to charge the phone very often and you only charge it at night, does it really matter how fast the wired is? That's one of those kind of hits you take for a mid-range phone, but shouldn't be a big deal.
And its battery's bigger. Yeah.
It's weird that the battery's bigger. That's a whole thing.
I mean, it's only a tiny, tiny bit bigger than the Pixel 9 Pro XL, but technically the largest battery on any Pixel.
Looking at this phone, I still wonder, like, why is the iPhone 16e the way it is? And I guess it's just Apple, right? It's the way Apple rolls. Like, they're going to be more expensive than Android always. They're probably going to have fewer features. You're paying the Apple tax, literally. Yeah.
I wonder if Tensor is a cheaper chip than the Apple silicon stuff is to make, maybe? Like, we all know one of the huge reasons the 16e is expensive compared to an SE is the A18 that's in there. One of many reasons. You'd get poorer screen, you get only one camera. Like, I can't imagine what else is in there that's expensive. So I don't know. I don't know about the fabrication of these chips and whether there's that, or that, you know, Google's taking more of a loss compared to, and they're not making losses, but they're, you know, the margin-wise, they're taking a smaller margin, maybe. I don't know.
The Tensor chip is nowhere near as powerful as, like, the Apple stuff. So that's probably easier to produce and cheaper, like you're saying. But also that OLED screen, Apple also once again put, you know, an OLED in the iPhone 16e. And there's an OLED here too, right? So
yes.
OLED has gotten cheaper, but I just feel like for the cheaper iPhone, I think people would have been fine with a very bright LCD and, you know, some of the AI.
If you had to choose between OLED or an LCD with 120 hertz refresh rate and a 60 hertz OLED, that becomes a lot more interesting of a trade-off.
Yeah, for sure. You could get a higher refresh rate. But the key here, you guys keep bringing up the Tensor chip. This one has... it has, you know, AI features. So that's pretty useful too. And I guess the iPhone 16e has that, but I feel like that's also part of why you're paying a little more for it, I guess, right?
Although, I mean, Apple Intelligence people have, you know, not been super enthused about that as of late. And so, you know, at least in terms of just like each company's AI portfolio, I think Google has the clear advantage here. I do want to make a note that, you know, because of like the reduced core count on the Tensor G4 for the Pixel 9a, you don't get access to like a handful of features. Probably the biggest one is a Pixel screenshot app, but this is, you know, we're still trying to like get the full details on that because obviously we don't have devices in hand yet. The phone isn't on sale. So, you know, keep tuned for when we do, you know, obviously we're going to have a review coming for that.
There was a report that I think you guys were referring to that says that this thing is running a smaller, you know, AI model, a smaller Gemini model than the other phones. Do we know that for sure yet? Because those do exist. The smaller models are out there.
I think you're referring to an Ars Technica report, Devendra, which that's what I was kind of thinking of as well when we were talking about these AI features things. Sam, you were also in this conversation yesterday, I remember, where 8 gigs of RAM seemed to be the problem and or also the fewer cores in the Tensor G4. But you seemed to pay more attention to the article than I did.
Yeah. No, and so what the you know, what we've heard is that the phone has Gemini Nano, but specifically on the Pixel 9a, it's a even kind of more streamlined version of Gemini Nano. So it doesn't have full access to everything. And so that kind of does limit some of the AI capabilities just a tiny bit. You still get like Pixel Recorder and all of like your basic like, you know, live transcription, translation stuff. So, you know, for the most part, Google's AI suite is still mostly intact, but that's one of the things we want to pay attention to, you know, when we get a chance to review it, is just like, you know, what are the true differences in terms of capabilities?
This is, as all these companies are talking about their AI features, by the way, it is something worth keeping in mind because not all every AI phone or AI PC is built the same. They have a wide variety of models that can be deployed across all these machines. So it seems like this one has one of the smallest Gemini models. And I don't know how can Google like really market that compared to like what the Pixel 9 itself can do. But something to keep in mind for like an informed buyer. You're just not going to get all the shiny AI stuff. Can you talk about the features it doesn't have, Sam? Or at least that we think it doesn't have?
Mostly it's, you know, not compared to like the standard Pixel 9, you know, slower charging, both wired and wireless. And then, you know, no Pixel screenshot app, which is definitely a bummer because I think, you know, that is actually one of the most useful AI features that Google has introduced as of late. And obviously, you don't get a telephoto. You have two cameras in the back, a 48-pixel main sensor, which is similar but not quite the same as the one on the Pixel 9 Pro Fold. And then you get a ultra-wide 13-megapixel sensor. And then you do get support for a macro focus feature and super res zoom, but those are more software, not just, you know, physical optics for those two.
Mm-hmm. I have to say macro focus is something I did not think would be very useful on the iPhone and Android, but it's really helped me in certain situations. So
it's more of a situational thing unless you like really like taking pictures of like close up flowers or bugs or stuff like that. I find it, you know, we went through like a phase in smartphones where a lot of companies were, hey, let's figure out a way to put two cameras on the back of the phone. And on budget phones, they would do main sensor and then an ultra wide with a macro. And a lot of those macros were just awful. They were just like really shallow depth of field, really hard to focus. So, I mean, it's nice that you get a little bit more capabilities, but I still find, at least in terms of like main, zoom, ultra wide, that the ultra wide slash macro is usually the one that I use the least.
I use ultra wide a lot, but I have to point out, Sam, you and I attended the Pixel briefing and you did write a hands-on with the Pixel 9a. The caveat here is that, like Sam already said, we don't have phones in hand. We don't have this thing is selling ostensibly in April. We think that's what the company said. And then at the Pixel hands-on, what we could try or test out was limited. So I couldn't even tell you if this macro mode is necessarily as good as the Pixel 9 lineup.
Right. We weren't able to test out almost any of the features. We could, you know, check out the physical design of the device and, you know, flip around some, you know, screens on the home screen. And that was about it. And it's really weird because it's like, you know, historically, the Pixel 9a has launched at Google I.O. or at least like a week before it. And now they're kind of jumping the gun. This is like, you know, almost 2 months before Google I.O. And so it seems, I don't know if it's like the rollout is like rushed or like not rushed in the way that it needs to be. I felt like they could have, you know, been a little bit more patient because, you know, what's the best thing about having an announcement and then you have pre-orders available that day? Apple's been very, very good about this in the past. It's like you don't want to announce something and then make people wait just to be able to buy it. You should be able to have pre-orders and then, you know, shipping a concrete date when you announce it. Like, why are you going to announce something if you don't have a concrete shipping date, right?
Isn't part of the story that it was delayed? Like, I think Google, from what I've read, there are component issues that cause them to delay this phone even further. It was supposed to be released sooner. Have you guys heard about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the big issues between component issues and then the whole tariff situation is like throwing every tech company device maker into a thing. And, you know, maybe there's some speculation that, hey, that's the reason why Apple made the 16e a little bit more expensive is to kind of roll in those tariffs kind of preemptively. Who knows?
I will say that it's a little bit, and I'm very being like much kinder than I am in my head about this. Uh-huh. It is really annoying to see that there are people on YouTube or whatever with the device already posting their reviews, and we were limited as to what we could even touch at the hands of our use. It is quite annoying because we think very carefully about the devices that we write about, recommend to people, and all, because our credibility is very important to us. And you will see the language in our hands-ons that we won't generally recommend anything we haven't tested for at least a few days in our own lives, in our own homes. So already we weren't going to like fully recommend something that we only saw at a hands-on, but to be so limited and be like, yeah, this is a hands-on. We were very much like not certain about it. I will say the only difference is that we did touch it. We did hands-on it. This thing seems to actually work fine. But like then there's YouTubers out there with the whole ass thing that they
and
could
they
use
have all the features and they have reviews. Yeah,
so
with
like
the
what's the there's not component issues, right? It's like something like this whole situation, the way it's played out, has led me to think that there's some serious issues with getting the Tensor G4 in the Pixel 9a to run these Gemini things properly. And to be clear, I haven't seen these videos on YouTube, so I don't know what they've said. But I've always been like something's very suspicious. However, now I'm like, if they're in people's hands, they're not that suspicious. Yeah. They seem ready to roll off the assembly line.
Do we have, like, did you guys talk to Google PR about this? Or are there spokespeople about, like, why these limitations are here? When the review units are out there? Yeah.
Oh, about that. I mean, I didn't go ahead. I have, like,
oh, man. Okay, so, yeah. Sam? This is, like, when Sam and I were at Dell. I love to be annoying to the PR people, especially when, like, these companies, we are there. Yes, we're there at their invitation to check out their new stuff, whatever. But if they're giving us garbage, like if you're just BSing me about something, it's like, this is the point where we gotta like push back on them. So I don't know. I don't know if Google has said anything.
It sucks. To be clear, and Sam can, I think, agree on this, the hands-on happened before those videos came out, so we couldn't push them in person. Since then, when we push, it's been through like email or whatever. And it's, you know how hard it is to get responses via that channel, right?
So
Sam, I don't know. We didn't see those videos when we went to the hands-on.
No. Those videos came out after we got a chance to go hands-on. But this has kind of like been an issue with Google for a long time where, you know, they have full devices that just straight up get leaked. I think this happened with the Pixel 7 or Pixel 6. There was a bunch of people in Russia who just got full devices and were making full review videos. And, you know, Google's entire strategy kind of hinges upon some of this too, where like a lot of times they'll just announce the next version of Pixel 9. They'll show up like a full image of it like 2 months before the official date. Remember, like this happened last year where they showed off the Pixel 9 before the official launch day because they kind of, I think, know that it's going to get leaked. So they might as well get out ahead of the leaks. So it's just like, you know, a lot of companies go, you know, they spend a ton of time trying to combat leaks, and some companies try harder than others. So I don't know if this is something that Google needs to focus more on again, but I guess that's how it is.
I think in past years, it almost seemed like some of the leaks were maybe even Google planned because...
Yeah, Mike Jones Jr. in the chat is like, totally unintentional. Quote,
totally leaks. Unintentional. Like, the people are not out there clamoring for, like, when is the next Pixel A series phone coming? I don't know. Like, sometimes you get to, like, trump up your own, like, juice and buzz, I guess. Also, I kind of feel like they hit this out early because we don't know what the state of sales is like, but it could be that Google needs a new, cheaper phone, especially now that the iPhone 16e is out.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think I could be wrong, but, you know, the Pixel sales have been growing steadily year over year, and the 8A was kind of a banner tentpole device for them.
And the 9 lineup, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think at least the momentum is kind of in their favor, but, you know, who knows? Like, anything can derail momentum like that.
I think if we continue to see this trend, because Google has been proven to be a bit reactive in its news announcement windows before, right? With Bard coming out the day or week of Bing AI being announced and like seemingly the day before in reaction to rumors. This also seems like, to your speculation, that it is a reaction to the iPhone 16e. I wonder if that's the reasoning. It wouldn't be past them because it seems to fit with their history. Kevin says in the chat is also like, oh yeah, but Google uses marketing teams that are, you know, from outside for different regions. So it might not really be Google doing it. And like, I to an extent, I think that's fair, but I hesitate. I can't believe they have no repercussions from seeding a device way ahead of the rest of the North American, at least, team. So
yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think an external marketing team would do that. Otherwise, that's the last job you have from Google.
They would
no longer have
Google as a client. Yeah.
This has to be approved. But maybe they pitch it sort of like, hey, man, we got these Russian live streamers out here who could really, really generate some buzz for whatever.
Could be jurisdiction of like, nobody in certain countries cares about breaking certain rules, and therefore they just go ahead and do it, maybe. But yeah. Well, that might be a bit inside baseball. I don't know.
For sure. That's a lot of talk about the Pixel 9a. Is there anything else you guys want to add about this thing? Because it's a mid-range phone. I think it's going to have a wide appeal, but also, come on. we have other news to move on to.
Yeah. I mean, in short, like, I like the price. I like the design. I'm not upset about the camera bar going away. And it kind of has everything you want in, you know, a $500 phone. Obviously, the specs aren't as impressive as like a Chinese phone, which always delivers like, you know, super high performance for the money. So I'm really excited to think. The one question I have is like, at what point does the Pixel 9a kind of start to really encroach on the standard Pixel 9's territory? Because you're getting so much of it for $300 less. I'm curious to see kind of how that plays out in terms of like positioning on future devices. But that's, you know, gotta wait and see.
Go ahead, Trillin.
Oh, no, I just want to say that, like, Sam is comparing the 9A to the 9, and I want to point out, Simon says in the chat, was like, you should compare it to the OnePlus versions as well. And, you know, Ben was like, oh, yeah, you know, we don't have the OnePlus here in the US, which is, I believe, correct. I can't remember. I don't think there's been a new OnePlus announced recently. But what we should compare it to is something like the Nothing Phone 3A, which comes in at around the same price, the 3A Pro, I believe, or Samsung announced last couple weeks ago at MWC, the Galaxy A56, which comes in exactly $499. The problem with the A56 is that it's unclear whether it's going to be, we talked about this, the availability in the US seems a bit spotty, and it's going to be for sure available in the UK. So as usual, overseas regions, Europe, Asia, etc., have more access to mid-range phones from makers that are not just Apple and Google and Samsung. But we don't know. Nothing Phone 3A Pro and 3A will be available through a beta sort of program in the US, but that does mean that the supply seems to be limited.
Yeah, very few people will see that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it looks nice. I just wanted to bring up that, like, yeah, there's also other phones that would be worth considering in this price range. So for the full details on what you should consider, definitely go to Engadget.com.
But they wouldn't have all of the Gemini features, right? They wouldn't have the Tensor
right.
chip.
The AI stuff everything. Wouldn't be baked in the way it is in Pixel.
That's kind of, yeah, the defining feature here. To what you were saying, Sam, it feels like for a lot of these companies, if you're not Apple, right, you have 6 months to really sell your high-end new thing. And then after that, people may be looking for deals, you know, so that's like, okay, you have a cheaper phone that more people would probably buy at a much lower price coming in a little later. And I think that's the balance, like new thing and then slightly less good thing, but cheaper. They've probably made as many of the Pixel 9 sales as they could have, you know, up until this point. Because now people are waiting for whatever the next thing is. It's March, right? So now you're like, okay, well, next Pixel phone coming soon, I guess, right?
Soon.
I don't know. It all feels like, listen, it is close to the end of March. I'm already thinking about things like Microsoft Build and whatever events are happening in the middle of the year. And then, like, yeah, before you know it, it's iPhone time. Anyway, folks, stay tuned for our coverage of the Pixel 9a. We still need to get review units, and that'll all be coming soon. Thanks, Sam and Trolin, for this. Let's move on to some other news. And actually, something that broke this morning that I saw a lot of people were excited about is Fujifilm's new GFX 100RF, which is a 102 megapixel medium format compact camera. That is a lot of words. That also means like this is kind of a hell of a camera. It is almost $5,000.
I was going to say, don't forget the price.
It's 49 because it's a medium format camera. That is like, you know, heavy duty, pro level stuff. I am less of a camera guy. I just like looking at the specs and the pretty hardware. But Sam, Sherlyn, do you guys have thoughts on this thing? It's weird. It's a fixed lens camera, 28 millimeter lens, f4 lens.
And so that's where you lost me. Is that fixed lens? If I'm gonna buy a $5,000 camera, I got to be able to put different lenses on it. It's like an f4 is fine, but once again, if you are spending that kind of dough on a camera, especially on a fixed lens camera, you got to give me like f2, f2.8 at least, just so you know you have a little bit more control over depth of field and stuff like that. And so this is like the most Fujifilm camera of all time because it's like, oh, this is like lovely crafted, and you got the, you know, the traditional Fujifilm dials and all that, and it looks nice, and you have the black one and the two-tone silver and black one. It's like, I'm sure there's a bunch of film pseudo film settings and stuff like that, and so it's great, but it's like, if you are actually want a practical camera that you can take around, that's awesome. This is sort of like the ultimate like range finder camera, yes, where it's like you want the most overkill like thing for going around taking street photos in a city. This is really cool, but to me, this is like in Leica territory where it's like very nice to look at, and I'm sure it's a joy to use, but I will never afford one, and so it's like hard for me to get super excited about it.
We can covet it, basically. So Steve Denton, who wrote up the story for us, says this is really competing with the $6,600 Leica Q3. So it's cheaper. It's, you know, it's a lot cheaper than the Leica.
Wow, so competitive.
So competitive. That's quality right there. But also, people who love cameras and photographers, I know, like, those folks drop $1,000, $2,000 on a camera like nothing. You know, if they're actually in this as a hobby and they have a collection of cameras, they have all sorts of stuff, I could see this being a really useful thing for a lot of people. I'm just that the fact that it's fixed frame lens and also that f-stop is just not, it just seems a little too high for me. Yeah.
That is wild. It's pretty especially camera. For the money. Jeez.
Especially for the money. So that's your, okay, we'll whet your appetite with gadgets. And then there were some other things we want to dive into. One of the big stories over the last week is Sarah Wynne Williams, the former Chase Facebook worker we talked about last week, actually, is in the process of releasing a book called Careless People. The book is out, but Facebook last week, her lawyer stopped her from promoting the book because of the NDA. We have some coverage on it. Carissa Bell has, I believe, just sped through and read the whole thing, and she has like carved out some highlights from us, including things like Mark Zuckerberg requested to be gently mobbed, during a visit to HI. I don't know what that means, but so I would love to be. I would love to be gently mobbed. Just step into the room and everybody praises you. It's awesome. He refused to take meetings before noon, even with heads of state. He built a Meta built a special room to protect him from Zika while he was visiting Peru for the APEC conference. And he was desperate to talk to Xi Jinping. A lot of things. A lot of cringe things. I've also seen...
When did Xi Jinping to name his kid that was known for a while, I think, right?
Yeah. Yes. It turns out, like, these folks just want... They're always just, like, bowing to more and more power, I guess. So it was not too surprising when Mark Zuckerberg was like, oh, Trump's in power now. I just gotta... Just gonna give it all up for him.
Hold up, though. I need to jump in about the Mark Zuckerberg Zika thing because Carissa says that this was part of something that Facebook people called Operation Perfect Sperm. I think he was afraid of like his sperm quality going down
if
he were to get Zika.
Okay.
I don't know when this was happening. I don't know if he was, you know, on the way toward another kid. Yeah, that's something that he cared a lot about.
I mean, listen, you're worth billions of dollars. You're one of the richest people on earth. You're like, I gotta care about my legacy. I gotta make sure my genes are all correct.
Okay, yes, yeah. But now he's thinking of himself as a sire. That's weird, dude.
He's hanging out with Elon Musk a little too much, I guess. I don't know there. So anyway, we have a lot of coverage on this thing. This book seems wild. I'm looking forward to reading it. I have seen some pushback from people who used to work at Meta who also worked with this person who say, like, some things may be overblown. She didn't really, like, maybe she is, like, basically milking a lot of these stories to sell a book, which, sure, yes, that's also happening. But what's also funny... Because I think I've also worked, I think I directly worked with somebody, one of the people pushing back. And those were also one of the people's, it was somebody who I had a really weird interaction with when it came to covering Meta and Facebook stuff. It was when they were releasing the portal cameras. Remember those? Facebook released cameras. And my direct question was, you know, people don't really trust Facebook anymore. They don't really trust you as a company. Why do you think they'll trust you, you know, putting cameras in their homes? And the reaction I got back from this person, who was like senior level marketing lady, who yeah I believe was one of these people, she was like, oh yeah, people are concerned, people have concerns about Meta. It was a really weird pushback thing, like a really snarky way of saying, oh yeah, people are concerned about Facebook, you know, and their privacy. These people all exist in their own bubble, right? Like they're all. Smoking
very insulated,
the Facebook
yeah.
They're very insulated. They're all like they're close to Mark Zuckerberg. I don't know who to trust fully here, but the book sounds it sounds funny. It sounds like something that's worth reading. Yeah.
Just some of the excerpts are just like incredible.
The excerpts, sorry?
The excerpts from the book.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
There's another one Joel Kaplan, who is their current chief of global affairs officer this year. Apparently, he used to work for the, you know, George W. Bush administration, and he was, quote, surprised to learn that Taiwan is an island. And it's like, okay, what else could it be?
That's a relevant to you excerpt for sure, too, Sam, with Taiwan and everything.
Definitely. Taiwan is both an island and a country, so...
Yeah. The thing I wanted to point out is that, like, to reframe this for some of our listeners too, or at least just for us, right? It would be like I wrote a book about Engadget, about some of the past history that has happened, and people who have left us or like people who still work here are like, oh, but Sherlyn doesn't know what she's talking about.
Yeah.
Instead of saying like, oh, actually, yeah, that did happen. And it's no longer, like, for me at least, like, for example, oh, it's no longer the Engadget that I know today, or I was not involved in this or whatever. Like, just being accepting of that, like, some of the facts can be, you know, facts that we didn't know. Or,
everybody
like,
has their own perspective. Yeah.
Exactly.
Don't trust the people rushing out to basically defend Mark Zuckerberg. That's what some of the people felt.
I agree.
Like.
I'm not going to go out and defend, like, people I never knew also, just like people in an organization's history, maybe like Yahoo's top manager from like years ago. I don't know. What am I supposed to say, you know?
Shalyn's not going to go to the mat for Xing Yi, okay? She's not going to defend Xing Yi and all of his actions.
I once took an elevator with Xing Yi. We said no words
Remember
to each other.
Look at Xing Yi on YouTube.
I'll go to bat for him. Dude has great hair.
He has great hair. He rode that hair all the way to the executive suite, basically. So yeah, it's great.
He liked his office.
He liked his office, yeah. We're going to move on.
Yeah.
In less fun news, I guess less directly entertaining news, this week, Trump has fired the FTC's two Democratic commissioners.
He has attempted to fire.
They're fighting it back. So that's the whole thing. Rebecca Kelly Slaughter and Alvaro Bedoya are basically fighting back against this firing. The FTC, historically, I believe the way it's made up, right? It's an agency made up of three people of the president's party and then two people from the opposing party. It's supposed to be constructed in a way so that there is at least some sort of balance, even if the main party will have a majority. And both of these folks, both Rebecca Kelly Slaughter and Alvaro Bedoya, have released statements about it too. I'm going to read Slaughter's statement here. The law protects the independence of the commission because the law serves the American people, not corporate power. The reason that the FTC can be so effective for the American people is because its independence and because its commissioners serve across political parties and ideologies. Removing opposition voices may not change what the Trump majority can do, but does change whether they will have accountability when they do it. So this is an ongoing story. Certainly not good, because the FTC is, that is the arm of the government that's doing things to basically protect consumer rights and deal with things like consumer products. Do you guys have thoughts on this? Because like it's so like blatantly illegal, so blatantly wrong, and it's not going to lead to great things. But yeah, go ahead, Ben.
I have thoughts about this to start. It's so crazy that when this news came out, people online, especially any reporter with a legal background, was saying that they were trying to relitigate Humphrey's Executor, which is a Supreme Court case from the 1930s about, again, whether or not a president can fire a FTC employee. The crazy thing about it is that the first time they did this, it was FDR trying to fire an FTC employee because they were insufficiently like gung-ho on the New Deal. And now they're trying to do it again because it seems like they're trying to do the exact opposite. It's like the mirror image.
We need to break everything that was built over the last 100 years. That's the ticket. Also worth pointing out, these two folks were Lena Khan's, basically her deputies. Like, they were working alongside her lieutenants. We talked a lot about like what Lena Khan did and how she was fighting against the state of monopolies, how she was fighting against Amazon. The FTC was doing a lot of interesting work during the Biden administration, and that's... it's all up in smoke, like so many things. We are also sitting and waiting to see what's going to happen to the Department of Education. And not great stuff. We are going to follow this story, and we're going to be following all this stuff as it relates to the technology world and also consumer rights and all those things. But it's worth making you guys aware, like, it is a dangerous thing. It's illegal, but it's also dangerous, and it's also signaling what the Trump administration intends to do by trying to fire these two FTC commissioners. All right. Next story, Amazon. Not too many like happy stories this week. We're going to end on one that's maybe a little fun. But there is also the story that broke over the weekend that Amazon's getting rid of the option for Echo devices to process Alexa voice requests locally. That means they're all going to be going to the cloud soon. I actually forgot that they announced this thing. I guess they announced it over privacy concerns, right? But it seems like they want everything back in the cloud because they need voice data to train Alexa Plus and their AI stuff. Thoughts, folks?
I so again, please mute your speakers. But I also saw recently, which by the way, it's March already, right? And the February Amazon event did say that this early previews of these more intelligent assistant are going to be available this month. So I was able to sign up through the Amazon app, and I did. Still haven't tried it out for myself yet, which is my huge caveat here, right? Like, this thing ostensibly ready for early previews, still not something that you can actually try out for yourself, at least not to my knowledge. So I am not surprised if this was because, like you said, Devendra, they need more data to train this LLM-based assistant because it's not reacting the way it's supposed to or responding in a lot of edge use cases the way it's supposed to. I mean, Sam, you and I were there at the Amazon event. The demos they gave were so canned, so rehearsed, and it seemed like only in five specific situations would the assistant respond the way they want it to, right? And then what if you were asking not about your Ring camera feed and Huskies? What if you were asking about actual important stuff. Like, was there someone breaking into my house at midnight? Or did a raccoon, I guess a raccoon's identifiable. But like, that's where I'm at, right? Like, I guess I wouldn't be surprised, even though I prefer on-device than local processing, right? I don't know if it makes a difference if you don't use the smarter Alexa at all. Yeah.
It's all these things are making me think I should just turn off my Alexa devices. Go ahead, Sam. Yeah.
The thing that's really confusing is that if you look at like the kind of, you know, trends for AI stuff in general, more and more companies, Google, Apple, et cetera, are trying to move more stuff on device because they know that not only do people feel better about, hey, my privacy, my data is staying on the thing that I can actually hold in my hand, but it's also just you get better responses when you don't have to, you know, wait for to ping the cloud every time you want to do something. So it seems really weird that kind of Amazon is kind of bucking or zagging in terms of just like doing less on device than its competitors. That just seems like a weird about face.
I will say that we were just saying that Amazon event did not have any hardware either, right? I wonder if it's because the existing hardware cannot handle LLM processing. Right, it's so old.
I think that's probably a big thing. Like, you won't be able to do on-device LLM processing. Like, all the Apple stuff, you need a lot of RAM.
And in fairness, yeah, there is a benefit to that because all of the existing Alexa devices, all the old Echoes, even back like the original Echo, will get support for Alexa Plus at some point. So by, you know, leveraging that cloud model, they don't have to rely on like the old chips from 10 years ago in the original Echo.
You are still using older Wi-Fi standards, depending on
Yeah, you're
on
still using older
Echo.
Wi-Fi standards and a lot, maybe the mic, you know, they didn't, far field mics have come a long way in the last, you know, 5-10 years. But still, you know, so there is some benefit to doing the like total cloud-based server approach. It just seems a bit weird, especially since, you know, they hired Panos Panay from Microsoft, and dude knows about hardware. Like, it seems like he should be able to figure out some way to kind of bridge that gap in terms of like, hey, for our older devices that don't have great chips, maybe they'll, you know, use the server model. And for upcoming future devices that have more, more recent silicon, then maybe they have that kind of two-pronged approach. But so it seems weird to kind of, you know, kind of have this kind of slightly ham-fisted strategy to, you know, AI and server processing.
I think they just don't want to say it because you're right, Sam. Like, what's most likely going to happen is newer devices are going to have more hardware in there that can do a lot of this stuff on board, and maybe that could be a selling point. Like,
and faster, hey, maybe, yeah.
You've had your Echo. Sell privacy back to us.
Sell privacy back to you. You've had your Echo for 5 years plus.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
that's great.
That's what's going to happen. That's the only way we get privacy is if these companies can make money off of it. But yeah, they sell you a new one, which has more RAM and everything, and that can be the thing that maybe does it locally. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, can I point out that in the chat, there's some really good points, right? Like DeepRow9 is like, I'm going to feed it junk data for fun. And I believe Kevin says, is like, yes, switch on the assistant and just play adult content to it. And Two Simon says this point in the chat as well, like these devices are all quite slow at the moment, even without, you know, like cloud processing. So it's just all, and also, by the way, the last thing I wanted to point out from the chat, which is a really good question, Declan is like, what about the Amazon Kids speakers? Are those also going to the cloud and being used? So it's a lot. It's, you know, it seems like a simple story at first glance, but then now that I think deeper into it, it's just
there
like,
are layers
wow,
to it.
Okay.
There are layers to it. It also makes me think like, I don't really want to be a part of the whole Alexa Plus thing. I actually done. I'm less inclined to like Amazon at this point. So what are your choices, right? You go to Google's platform. You go to Siri, I guess, and the HomePod platform. I wish there was just like speaker hardware out there and you could roll your own like little LLM, your own little like thing that you talk to, and that is just on your device. And I think that may be where we're probably headed to, like looking at how Blue Sky was created, looking at how people are thinking of hardware now. I have a Framework laptop right here. And the fact that they are able to sell those things and give us a completely different way of like buying and thinking of hardware, I would love to see more of that because having a voice assistant is great. Having a speaker you could talk to is great. It's just we can't trust these companies. So I wonder. I do wonder what the hackers and the techies are going to do about this stuff. Talking about major changes, by the way, BYD announced something pretty interesting over the last Over the last week, I saw a lot of people in the EV world really buzzing about this. They announced a Super E platform in China with peak charging speeds of 1,000 kilowatts. That's double the 500 kilowatts offered by Tesla superchargers. That means you could charge a car for 249 miles in 5 minutes. That's pretty good. That's actually pretty good. That's very close to pumping gas. Still not nearly as much. But Sam, have you seen this? What do you think about this news? Because you're thinking about EVs as well now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really great, you know, positive change. Obviously, it's going to, you know, we have to see how long it's going to take for that to trickle down to actual consumer cars. And obviously, the other thing you got to think about is infrastructure, right? Because even if you have a car that can charge that fast, you need to be able to have the chargers in available places so that people can actually access those capabilities. And so obviously, you know, the rollout, the tech sounds great. The rollout kind of remains to be seen. But like you said, it really does eliminate that kind of last thing about range anxiety, is that you're in an emergency, you are low on juice, and you just need something to get you to where you're going. You can plug in for 5 minutes. That's just as fast as, you know, refilling your gas car, and then you'd be on your way. And so that is kind of like the last hurdle in terms of just like making, you know, long distance trips a little bit more palatable, or, you know, in emergency situations where you just need something.
Yeah. How is how has the range been with you? Because I know you've been driving a Mach-E for a while.
Yeah.
Sam,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You drive into Connecticut. You take road trips. How have you managed it with your family?
To me, and everybody, this is kind of what everybody says across the industry, is that the biggest, most effective way to combat range anxiety is to give someone an electric vehicle. Because once they have one and they drive one all the time, they'll really see how much mileage they use. And, you know, most people, the stat is like between, you know, 60 and 70 miles is how much people drive on a daily basis. And even for me, that's like way more than what I use. And when you're talking about cars that have 200, 250, 300 miles of range, you know, suddenly, you know, if you are doing 60 miles, you always have so much left in the tank. It's kind of like how battery anxiety for smartphones used to be a really, really big concern. And now it's just like, it's nice to have more battery life. But when was the last time you were just like, oh, I can't use this device because I have to charge it all the time? Like, that's not really a thing you have to think about anymore.
I think of the early iPhone era, right? That is what you're thinking of. And when people are like, oh, I'm going to give up my iPod and my music player and everything and just do it all on my phone. I think at that point I was like, actually, I see how long this film lasts. I listen to a lot of music.
But,
and actually,
I mean, that was almost literally 10 years ago. Like,
more than 10 years ago.
Where you had to think about like, oh, how much am I using my phone, and like how much is that going to impact the battery life?
And it's changed. Since then, it's changed, and I use my phone for everything. I totally agree. Also, people, if you have not lived the life of just like, if you have an electric car and you're able to plug it in at home or in your apartment complex or something, that is where you're doing most of the charging. And most of the time, you're not even thinking about it, right? You're
oh my
driving
goodness.
At
yeah.
home.
If you have the luxury of having a garage or you can install a charger in your garage, an EV makes so much sense for you, because you just come home at the end of the day, you plug in the night, and your car will always be like 80% or 100% ready to go when you need it. And then you never have to go to a gas station again. And like, honestly, that's like one of the greatest things about owning an EV is just not going to gas stations.
It's just such an alien concept. And I think a lot of people, like, you can't compute it until you live it. Go ahead, Ben.
I have a question for the class. So this is dumping a whole lot of power into the battery all at once, really, really, really fast. How is this fast charging different than the fast charging that made the Galaxy Note 7s explode?
It wasn't the fast charging that made those explode. It was the battery, yeah.
Yeah, if we go back and look at the Galaxy Note, one of the issues is that they tried to put a battery that was too big in a phone that really had really tight tolerances. And so what happened was that the phone was kind of squeezing the battery, and that in some cases it would squeeze the contacts on the battery together and the battery would short out. Obviously, you know, that's a bad thing because you don't want sparks near your battery, and then that's how we got fires. So this is actually sort of a different kind of issue where they have to pump a ton of energy into a battery. And the challenges for that is like, you got to make sure the battery is cooled and then you're not kind of really stressing out the battery. And so that's another consideration you have to think is like, you know, putting that much energy into a battery that quickly, does that have impacts on battery longevity in terms of just like, you know, does your decrease the range over time? And so that's one of the things that, you know, kind of it remains to be seen. But, you know, so different challenges than, you know, what happened to the Galaxy Note 7. But it's nice to see that, hey, at least the tech is evolving a little bit.
It's cool to see the evolution. Ben, I don't know if you've seen a Tesla supercharger in action or like any of the fast charging things. There's a lot of cooling, like running at full speed. There's a lot of cooling. Like there's a lot of cooling there, like liquid cooling, I believe, too. Let's doing a lot of that.
Oh,
too.
Really?
There is cool. That. So there is a lot of heat and a lot of energy going through, and that's kind of how they're dealing with it.
And a lot of EV manufacturers, and this used to be a lot more rare in EVs, but it's becoming pretty much an industry standard where new EVs will have a heat pump on them, both to precondition the battery for faster charging, but also to help remove heat from the battery in cases like this where, you know, you're charging and it's generating a lot of heat for the battery. And so just heat pump technology in general has come a long way relatively quickly. And so that's actually, you know, really nice to see that, like, partly because the technology is advancing, but also, you know, complementary components are also helping kind of make this a little bit more achievable.
Mm-hmm. We're bringing up words that will also scare potential EV buyers, like preconditioning. Like, yeah, if you live in a cold climate, it's actually your battery has to warm up a little so it can actually take that charge well. And if you don't do that, then you have to wait a little longer in the thing. I want to quickly point out level one charging, which is literally just sticking your thing into an AC outlet. For most people, given the range people drive typically, it's not even anywhere near like 60, Sam. I think it was like under 50. I think it was more like 30 to 40.
Yeah, yeah. I'm for like the most like adventurous people. Yeah, it's like it's really low. Number.
So when I don't have an EV charger, but I do have, when I've tested these things, I plug it into level one, and in 8 to 10 hours, I get like maybe 30 miles in it, but that actually covers the amount I'm driving most of the time during the day and what I need for testing. So it's not ideal, but if you really don't drive that much too, like, you could also have an EV without an EV charger.
Yeah. And for a lot of people at home, the sweet spot is sort of level two charging, because all you need for that is like your 240 volt outlet that you usually plug into like a dryer or like an electric stove. And so a lot of people have that, or at least have the ability to put one of those in their garage for not a ton of money. I've seen installations, you know, well under $1,000 for installing, you know, an EVSE into your garage.
We need to have a whole episode about this. Like, just, hey, this is, you want to buy an EV, what's the experience going to be like? I honestly had that priced out for me, Sam, and it was like well over $1,000. So it depends on your power. It depends on your electrical panel.
Every house is different. If you have an old house, that can be very challenging, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other news, we saw that Pebble founder Eric Migakovsky, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, he introduced two new e-paper smartwatches. There was news that he was going to be bringing Pebble back, essentially, in some form. Are you guys excited about this at all? Like, they look like Pebbles. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I've been waiting all morning to talk about this. I am kicking myself. I saw Eric, again, Eric M. I have a hard time pronouncing the last name, at CES. And, you know, could tell he was taking meetings and was like, something is up. And then did not have the brain capacity to follow up. I mean, we connected. I know how to get in touch with Eric. But like, it's just, I'm like, oh, I should have seen this coming. I should have been on top of it. Look, listen, we covered it. And I will go over these two devices for you, right? Like Eric, the founder of Pebble, brought back these two, like, what looks like e-paper smart watches. One of them is the Core 2 Duo. It looks basically like the Pebble 2.
Wait, it's called the Core 2 Duo?
Yeah, I was going to... That's my biggest thing.
He loves Intel.
Yeah, wow. How is Intel going to let this slide? There's no way.
Don't
get me started.
He can't sell that.
I don't know, uh-huh. Right? Okay. We said the licensing and the like potential trademark issues was like, okay. And I suspect that's why you can't just call it a Pebble 2. Anyway, modern chips and, quote, new tricks, right? It has a black and white 1.26-inch e-paper display, a microphone, a, you know, polycarbonate body, and then a 30-day battery life. It will track sleep and steps, as well as carries a barometer and compass. That is the Core 2 Duo, which will start at $149, available in black and white. It's shipping in July, supposedly. And then there's the Core Time 2, which... less of an issue, I guess, with Intel. And this is what Eric has apparently called his dream watch. It is the Pebble Time Evolution, basically. Seems like, if you all remember that one. This one is a 1.5-inch, and these are both rectangular screens, by the way. A 64-color 1.5-inch e-paper display, a metal body, so not polycarbonate like the Duo 2, a flat glass lens, and a battery that also lasts about 30 days. It will have a touchscreen, heart rate monitor, microphone and speaker, IPX8 water resistance, and then, you know, pre-existing Pebble OS apps, which, like, okay, I don't know I don't know how. Yeah, I'm like, I guess they were open source-ish, but didn't Fitbit buy a lot of Pebble?
Nope. So I believe that Eric has been talking to Google, and Google agreed to open source a lot of the old Pebble software. And right. So that's part of the big thing of like how they can, you know, bring back some of the heritage and legacy of the original watches.
The Core Time 2, which I was just talking about, this one is available in black, white, and a potential third color to be announced in the future. And it will start at $225. So yeah, Pebble OS is open source. And according to our article anyway, quote, our article says this, both watches are fully hackable. I don't know how fully hackable we're talking. I will ask Lawrence who wrote the article, what he means. But it is open source, means you could probably like play around with the code yourself. And it therefore allows for the potential introduction of custom firmware. I like the idea where I'm just like, look, I used to be a tinkerer. I love code. I do not have the time to play around. I will try. But like, it's so exciting for me, right? Like, we've seen a lot of companies recently capitalize on nostalgia. And I guess this is a very specific kind of nostalgia, because you have to be such a serious geek to know Pebble and feel that love for Pebble.
Plus, the original founder is back. So there's, you know, a little bit of that continuity as well.
Exactly. It's not your straight cash grab. It's like someone that you probably can trust with this product because of the heritage. And yeah, I mean, I am really intrigued by the promise of the activity tracking in addition to the looks of it. I want a round one because I remember my favorite was my round Pebble Time. Oh, it was so gorgeous. So I'm waiting. I was already about to throw money at this and be like, I'm getting that Pebble Core Duo 2 one. Not Pebble. The Core Duo 2, 150. I will get it, but I will wait for the time, especially the round one. Anyway, Sam.
I was just going to say that, like, on paper, this looks like it would fit me really well. I'm just not in love with the design because it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Exactly. And like you said, I just prefer a round watch face. And so I kind of want them to make that version of it. Because for most purposes, all I really want my smartwatch to do is do notifications, do some basic health and fitness stuff, and then tell the time and do calendar things. And it's like,
yeah,
looks like this can do all of that. It's cheaper than your traditional smartwatch.
Right. It's by a lot too. It's a fraction. Well, it's about the same price as the Watch SE. The Apple Watch SE is $250 thereabouts. So this $225 one, the time two, right, might be a bit, you know, quite close. But I will say 30-day battery life is a huge, you know, draw. The drawback that I will point out is that, like, as someone who reviews a lot of Apple Watches and Pixel Watches, I'm already very used to screens being like the fast refresh rate that we see. Well, fast meaning like 60 hertz-ish. And I am already so used to seeing, like, when I'm during a workout, I can see my heart rate, I can see the countdown timer, the seconds are just jumping by. I don't know that these displays can refresh that quickly. I don't know that I need it, right? Like, I still don't know, right? Will I want the trade-off of better battery for a, like, less fast refreshing screen? I don't know. But look, I'm here to nerd out about gadgets. And this is right in my aorta. Like, this thing, you just put the ink in my aorta.
Aorta. In your aorta. Veins. You don't want to stick things in your heart. One. That's bad. You want to do that. I'm looking at our pictures of the old, the Pebble Time. And I forgot, like, that had a really cute form factor. Like, the edges were kind of rounded. And these, like, have longer square, like, more rectangular screens and square edges. And I'm like, it doesn't look as good. But
Casio meets Pebble in a way.
Did you ever see the Pebble Time round?
I have not seen the Pebble Time round. But I'm looking at, like, just the plain Pebble Time, like, had a really nice curves, basically. A nice rounded edges. It looks like a Mac device, basically.
Pebble Time round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From, I don't know when, but it's, like, one of the prettiest things. It's
That's what I want. Make the bezels smaller and put that color e-ink screen on there, and then that's right on my alley.
Eric, 100%. If you're listening.
Yeah, well, he's like,
first say my last name correctly, and then I will listen to you, okay?
Oh, I I will text.
If people buy these, maybe we will see around one company. I could see like having one alongside what you typically use, maybe an Apple Watch or something. But it's cool to see not Apple, not Samsung, not Google releasing something that could be useful as a smartwatch. So that's cool. They look good. I don't know.
Mark Dell in our chat asks a very good question, and I'll end this section with it, is how much AI will be in these new Pebble watches? And hopefully none. That's all.
Hopefully none. There's no AI in e-paper yet, and we won't see e-ink for reasons.
Well, there is AI in e-ink through the Kindle Scribe. Just FYI.
That's true. Oh, God. Amazon has to ruin everything. Last story, Lego Pokemon. Lego Pokemon are coming.
You were excited for that.
Yeah.
Audibly.
Audibly. I don't know. I feel like, Ben, you're the producer. You should keep your composure so we can keep the segment going. You failed.
Let's restart. Let's restart.
Lego Pokemon are coming in 2026. That's our last story. And that's fun. That's just fun news. I want to put Lego Pikachu. Come on.
Will that be cute, though, do you think? I haven't seen any pictures. I am going into this completely cold.
I don't think they've revealed them yet. All we see is a tail. We see a Pikachu tail, which is a series of Lego bricks. And I think it's a smart move because, kids love Pokemon, everything. Kids still love Lego. Still a pretty good brand. And Lego has been very smart to, produce things for every single age range. So there's, Lego Duplo for the really young kids. There's stuff for, intermediate levels. And then there's, it rises to adult levels. My kids going into the Lego store, that's one of the most fun things they can do, because it's like a little mini amusement park of just really cool stuff, but also really expensive Lego kits. So Lego is killing it. Lego plus Pokemon is why did it take them so long to do this? This seems like a no-brainer move, especially in the Minecraft era. You know, this should have been done a long time ago. Thoughts, guys?
Everything Lego is doing is so smart. It's not just staying in we just make building sets. They're let's do video games. Sure. Let's do Lego Indiana Jones, Lego Star Wars. And it works kind of bi-directionally. You play the Lego game and it reminds you to actually build Legos. And then you play with Legos and you're I think I might want to play that new Lego game. It's a very nice feedback loop.
Yeah, also going to say, I'm assuming that these are going to be full size or close to life size Lego Pokemon, because they actually already do sell some small Lego Pokeballs that have a 1-inch tall Squirtle. I bought one for my kid the other day, so that's interesting.
Not a choking hazard, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just watch them carefully.
Parents, watch your kids.
You know this.
Watch your kids. There's also a Lego Game Boy coming. This was announced way back in January that you could build a classic Game Boy with Lego. So, hey, fun times.
Yep. Yeah, but I was going to say, my wife bought me some Lego roses for Valentine's Day recently. And I was that's a really awesome gift. And it was one of the best Valentine gifts I've ever gotten. So it's Lego seems to be hitting it.
Stealing that idea.
Yeah, hitting it across the board on just coming up with good ideas for new sets.
It depends on the person, because those are nice kits, but it's also to some people, it's you got me work as a gift. I have to build this thing.
No, that's me with plants. Anytime people buy me actual plants, I'm like, you bought me a responsibility.
Let's move on to, we got listener mail. Got listener mail. Yay! From Kevin Says, who's in the chat right now. He's asking, I'm looking at the LG C5 and the matching 2025 Samsung OLED TV. Which one is best, or are they both kind of the same, and are the UI very different? Kind of leaning towards LG, as he has an LG washing machine and tumble dryer. Yeah, and thanks for the help, as this will inform their upcoming purchase. I do have to say, I kind of have ended up with a bunch of LG things all at once. I didn't initially plan this, but I have the LG washer dryer, and we just remodeled our kitchen, so we have the LG fridge that you can knock in the front and you see what's in the fridge, and my kids love it because all their snacks are there. And they're all in a single app, and the app is like, hey, your fridge filter is, something's wrong. You got to replace that right now. Or your washing machine has an issue. So it's actually really useful to have an app for a bunch of different devices that don't normally need apps. So I'll point that out. I know people have been liking the Samsung OLED TVs, and in many cases, they have been getting better reviews than LG's models. But I've been covering these things for so long. And I think at the very least, I am loyal to LG for always kind of sticking with high quality panels. They're always generally doing good work. They have done this so much longer than Samsung and other companies. There are good arguments that Sony's image processing is better. I think people like some features in the Samsung OLED TVs, and also their prices can go down. But also LG has been lowering prices as well. So I feel like keep an eye out for sales. The LG C5 would be a good bet. But if you see a good deal on the Samsung OLED, they're good. It's OLED. It's modern OLED. It's still going to look good no matter which one you choose. Sam, any thoughts, or Sherlyn?
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, that's a great point you make about having like one app to like monitor a bunch of like big ticket appliances. Because that's kind of where I'm at in my life, is like, I don't want another app that only manages one single thing, and I don't want to go through the sign up and process. So that's definitely something to think about. Also considers, like, do you have existing sound bars that you might want to pair with this? Because a lot of times, you know, an LG sound bar is just going to work naturally. It might have some special features that it can use when paired with an LG TV versus a Samsung. Otherwise, I think the picture quality is very, very close. One important thing to mention is that Sony has not announced its new 2025 TVs yet. That we're expecting that to happen sometime this spring, but, you know, no details just yet. So maybe wait until see that, and you have like a good look at, like, here's the three big players: LG, Samsung, Sony, and, you know, maybe you can better cross shop about that. But, you know, I think it really comes with, like, you know, you already say you have LG washer and dryer. I think it probably would fit in your life a little bit better. And on that perspective, I would kind of agree that, like, leaning LG probably makes the most sense.
Their hardware is also tends to be more reliable from what I've seen from Consumer Reports stuff too. So, like, more reliable than Samsung's appliances. Don't know about versus Sony TVs. That's a good question.
The one small thing to think about, I think Samsung's smart TV features are a little bit wider in terms of, like, they have more support for kind of like game streaming services natively in the TV. So if that's something that you think might interest you, just maybe see if that's, you know, something you would actually use in practice. Aside from that, I think panel versus panel, they're actually very close.
From what I've seen, Samsung software can be a little overbearing because, like, it feels like a computer. It feels like this is a whole thing happening here, and it's not as nimble as LG stuff. So
people have a very love or hate approach to the LG Magic remote with the, you know, physical waving around. But you should be able to get a sense of that if you just go to your local Best Buy and give it a shot.
I turned that off. I used the manual clicking thing. Also worth pointing out, be flexible. Because there are some crazy good deals out there, especially at the time of the year. Like, 2 years ago, I was able to get my dad, like, a 77-inch LG. Like, not a top. It was an A-series model. But he doesn't need 120 hertz. He needs OLED at 60 hertz. And it's still an incredible-looking and large screen. You're going to find old models for sale. I like to keep an eye on slick deals. We occasionally, like, pump out TV deals at Engadget as well. But keep an eye out. I would be iffy about refurbished units. I'd be iffy about reused or floor models because OLED panels are so finicky, but there are some great deals out there. Like, I've definitely seen the LG, really good LGs for 65 inches below $1,500. I've seen 77 inches hit like $1,500. So keep an eye out. The deals are out there. If you have a 65 inch TV right now, by the way, look at your room. How much space do you really have? Because if you're upgrading your TV, you could probably afford a 77-inch TV. And I've actually talked several people into getting a much bigger TV because their old TVs had, like, the huge bezels and they had, like, a lot of junk around them. So the OLEDs have no bezel. They have, like, they're super thin. There's, like, no extraneous real, like, coverage. But it also means you could fit a much nicer screen in a space that you previously, you know, put something smaller, unless you have, like, one of those, like, closed in entertainment centers.
I always tell people, get the biggest TV you can fit in your space, because in 2 or 3 years, when they come out with even larger sizes, you'll be like, oh man, I could have gone bigger.
You will regret that. Like, this is a big purchase. So if it's the difference between spending a couple $100 and you have the space for it, like, a 77 inch TV looks good as long as you're not sitting right up on it. I think for most living rooms, 65 inches is, like, at least the baseline of what you want to start with. Sherlyn, thoughts? It seems like you're thinking about TVs.
No, I was just laughing because Mark Dell in the chat said that he's waiting for a 65-inch foldable TV. So good for you.
I mean, any TV is a foldable if you try hard enough.
There was a 65-inch foldable TV. It was the LG Rollable that cost $20,000.
It was a Rollable. Yes, it did technically fold. Nothing happened with that. Anyway, Kevin, I hope that helped. And also, folks, drop us more questions, more emails at podcast@engadget.com. Real quick, around Engadget, Chris Holt has reviewed Assassin's Creed Shadows for us. He says it's an ambitious and captivating world that's stuck in the past. I totally feel that. I've also played an hour of this game at this point. I will add to this review, yes, all that, and he's played a lot of it, also cool as hell. Cool as goddamn hell. Like, if you like Assassin's Creed games and you've been waiting for, just get to Japan, Assassin's Creed, get to Japan. I want to use katanas to cut off people's heads. They have done it. And it's a lot of fun. It is both balancing kind of the stealthy stuff. It feels like actually a mixture of Tenchu and maybe a mixture of Onimusha at the same time, too, because there are two protagonists, and it co-stars Yasuke. And I think all that, like, he is a big beefier warrior. He has like big swords. He like barrels into people. And I think Naoe is the other protagonist, and she is like nimble and smaller, and she's like more of like traditional ninja type of person. And I like the gameplay differences. It's great. So I don't know, folks, check it out. Sam, are you planning to? You're not?
No, I just heard a lot of good things about it. Almost like it's a return to form for like the Assassin's Creed franchise, in terms of like you get the ninja stuff that you really, really want. And I think it's like, if you nail that, and you know, everything else will kind of fall into place.
Yeah. I also really liked Assassin's Creed Mirage, which is the really small one they put out, I think, last year. Their sense of place, the ability to create like a virtual world, I think is still really impressive, as long as you can deal with like the open world mess of like those Ubisoft games. Sam, you also had a really good rant. It's about damn time Microsoft made an Xbox gaming handheld. What do you want to reiterate on that, or encapsulate that argument?
So this is kind of following up on the rumor that, like, long last, it seems like Microsoft might put out some sort of Xbox gaming held, even though they might, you know, tap someone else to make it. But it's just like, it feels like the writing has been on the wall ever since the Switch came out, which was, what, 2017? And so it's like, or maybe even earlier, that I can't remember. But it's just like, Microsoft, this has been like low-hanging fruit on your tree. And with the explosion of gaming handhelds, we've seen, you know, Asus already has two out, Lenovo has made two, and all the other companies, Acer is getting into the mix. I saw one back at CES. And it's just like, Microsoft, you have such a great opportunity to come and put your stamp on a gaming handheld, help expand the Xbox portfolio. Phil Spencer's been out there saying for years that he doesn't consider the Xbox to be a single device or a single console. It's a platform, as we've seen with Xbox Game Pass Ultimate and, you know, game streaming, buy anywhere stuff or play anywhere, stuff like that. So it's like, not only can you put all of this on a single machine, make it affordable, make it portable, but you can finally, hopefully, fix the big issue that everybody has with Windows-based gaming handhelds, in that the UI is super clunky because you're often switching between, you know, maybe the handheld has a built-in touchpad, or you have to do the touchscreen to hit certain things. Make a dedicated like UI or a gaming UI for Windows and let this thing run it and be a showcase of, hey, there are things besides Valve OS that can be a really nice dedicated platform for portable PC gaming. And here's your opportunity. I hope they nail it, because it sucks to have, like, don't get me wrong, the Steam Deck is awesome and I own one. But it's like, yeah, I think there's a lot of people who, there are still a lot of advantages to having a Windows-based PC gaming system just for the compatibility. Hopefully we have more choices in the marketplace. And apparently this thing could come out as early as the end of this year, which sounds kind of crazy, but hey, make it happen.
I hope it does. I hope it, like, compared to, nobody needs a faster Xbox Series X, right? Like, given how bad their console market is right now, if anything, Microsoft seeing the success of the Steam Deck, honestly seeing the success of the Nintendo Switch, should have been like thinking about this for a while. But we know they're a slow moving company. It takes them a while to, like, Microsoft is such a big ship, like, changing directions, doing anything, even Xbox, like the Xbox division is so big compared to most other hardware companies. It's hard for them to change up, but it totally makes sense. Don't play the same game, right? That's always been Nintendo's secret. Don't play the traditional console game. That's something they've been following for a while. Go for a handheld that is cheaper and accessible and supports Game Pass, and put that in everybody's hands, you know? And the thing we talked about last week, if you're going to make a new box, make a box, make it a Windows box. Like, just make it a box that is fully open and lets people do what they need to do, or at least don't lock it down like an Xbox console, lock it down like a Windows PC. How about that? Because Microsoft knows how to do that. Don't be afraid if people want to put Steam games on that Windows box, because it's still, at the end of the day, an Xbox under their TV, and they may want to subscribe to Game Pass. That's another reason for them to subscribe to Game Pass. There's a lot of stuff I wish Microsoft were doing. especially seeing how badly the Xbox Series X has done. The S has done a little better because it's cheaper. But man, I kind of think about like all the strategy stuff like that could be really interesting right now for Xbox. We'll keep an eye out. We're interested in like this space. Let us know what you folks think. Is Microsoft done with the console market? Our editor-in-chief had written an editorial, I think, a year or two ago about that. Like, Microsoft should just get out of consoles. I always thought that was not quite the thing. Like, I think they should rethink consoles. A handheld plus a better, like, basically a PC box under your TV could be a way to do it. So,
I mean, the alternative is that Microsoft becomes Sega, right? And Sega has actually enjoyed a decent run as, like, being, like, a publisher only. But I think it's just nice to have a little bit more competition among gaming hardware. So I hope that Xbox or Microsoft doesn't give up on it entirely.
For sure, for sure. All right, so yeah, let us know what you think of that, folks. And working on, like, hey, we're gonna blast through this. Sam, you want to mention anything quickly that you're working on? I know you're testing the new Rivian and the Asus Z Flow 13. Quick thoughts on those?
No, just, you know, got a new EV to check out. This is the Gen 2 of Rivian stuff, so it has, like, support for their new like hands-free driving system. And then the Asus Z Flow 13 was that kind of really funky gaming tablet we saw back at CS, is the second gen version of this. So, you know, keep an eye out for those reviews. No concrete timeline yet, but I'm working on them in the background.
Cool. And we'll quickly run down our pop culture picks. I just want to say, hey, catch up on Severance. Severance season 2 is good. It's great. And I have seen the finale. I can't say anything about it, but I have seen it. And I'm working on a review like of the season for us right now. It's worth catching up on. I think this has been an incredible season of television. Anything else you guys want to mention? Sam, Sherlyn?
I mean, I know Sam has something, so I'll let him go first. Mm-hmm. I also have stuff.
I'm going to shout out Solo Leveling 2. The second season almost wrapped up. And it's just like, I appreciate this show because the show, the character is obviously like a Mary Sue or whatever you want to call it, which is like infinitely powerful, never really faces a lot of stress, but they still find a way to make it interesting. And I'm also getting some like weird vibes of like Hunter vibes, because the main character or the main antagonist right now is a bunch of like crazy powered ants. So kind of, you know, but Hunter was one of my favorite animes of all time. So it's interesting to see those kind of parallels. That said, I've also been watching Star Wars Skeleton Crew. And I just want to say, I do not get this show. Everyone I've talked to says this show is wonderful and heartwarming. And I'm like, I can't stand it.
It is for kids. It is literally a kids show. So I think that's
I'm watching it out of obligation because I have this weird, like, you know, association where I like Star Wars. It's like weird to say that people like Star Wars nowadays.
I like Star Wars. Yeah.
I think I'm on the second to last episode, and I can't, like, I just want to finish it so I never have to think about it again. I do not understand why people think this is a good show.
That's harsh, Sam. That is harsh. I liked what I've seen so far, and there have been really terrible Star Wars shows so far. But anyway, Sherlyn, anything you want to bring up?
I just saw Mickey 17 in theaters.
Yeah.
Suggested. I don't know how I feel. Like you said, exactly. It was just like not as good as Snowpiercer. Mm-hmm. I found Robert Pattinson's character kind of annoying. I think it's just designed
his accent or whatever he's doing in that movie is weird, right?
So confusing. It's so bad. I don't like it. Yeah, it fits with the character and that it's a bit annoying. I will say two shout outs in terms of pop culture things. One, quite well known but old movie, and you're gonna yell at me, Devendra. Mm-hmm. I watched Rat Race this past weekend as well.
Rat Race?
That I think it's from like 2001 or something. It stars Rowan Atkinson. I think John Cleese is in it as well.
Are you talking about a Mr. Bean movie over here? Rat Race? What?
Hell yeah! All the way back to Mr. Bean. The OG YouTuber that we know and love. No, I'm kidding. It's just like your typical like a slapstick comedy type of thing. It's just, I was expecting Rowan Atkinson to play a bit different of a character. Like,
I assure
more like
you,
Sherlyn,
nobody has talked about this movie in a decade. So
I know. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Rat Race. Wow.
I know.
Jerry Zucker's Rat Race. Yeah.
I don't remember where I saw it, but if you can, it's like, it's just a throwback. I remember like when I was super young in Singapore, I saw the like movie theater posters for it. So that's yeah. And then, yeah, I also saw a more recent movie. I don't know if you've heard of this one, both of you. It's called Oddity. It's, I believe, an English-made film that's a horror movie that is really creepy, really cool. Creepy. I think it's also fairly well-reviewed. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice. Okay, that's
creepy.
Good.
It's creepy. I really liked it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So there you go, if you're in the mood for creepy. Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Sam online at...
Sam Rutherford on Twitter, but I'm not really posting a lot anymore. I'm going to move to Blue Sky very
soon. Move to Blue Sky. Come on.
It has to happen. I'm just being slow about it.
Devendra, where can people find you online?
At Devendra on Blue Sky, and a podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me your favorite moments from Rat Race, I guess, because we're all old together, you can send them to me on Threads or Blue Sky, CHERLYNN.bsky.social. Email us your thoughts about the show at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on wherever you're listening to this podcast, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher. Put the e-ink in my aorta. E-ink? E-paper. Aorta.